Welcome to WPM, Writing, Publishing, Marketing. This is the March 2020 edition. We're starting our fourth year with this podcast. Those of you who are listening to the podcast, I want to remind you that there are 3 years of podcasts on the Mott Publishing site, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later. There's plenty to listen to. Usually our format is that we have three authors, and one talks about writing, and one talks about publishing, and one talks about marketing. And the reason we set it up that way is that this is co-sponsored by Mott Publishing and WSEA Community Radio here at in Portsmouth at their radio station. Mott Publishing is myself and my wife, and we got involved in publishing when my wife wrote a cookbook 9 years ago or so. And I wrote some music to go with it, and we went through a small publisher, and then we weren't happy with that publisher, so we started our own publishing company and became very active in the Seacoast writing community. And we found a lot of very interesting events going on in the writing community, and a lot of workshops and meetings and write-ins and things like that. But we didn't find anything that tried to cover the whole gamut of writing and marketing and publishing, from the time you get your idea through the fun of writing the book and the complication of publishing the book and the excruciating pain of marketing the book. And then so we try to cover all of that in each session. This year we're changing up the format a little bit. We're going to have special events based on months that are recognized as national whatever month. For example, April is National Poetry Month, and so our show will be primarily about poetry that month. This is the first event this year, and we have one guest. We have Roseanne Sedoya, and I will allow her in a moment to introduce herself. But because there are just the two of us, we're going to change the format, and I'll let Roseanne give a presentation for as long as she would like, and then I'll have a brief presentation, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. So, Roseanne, take it away.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me here this evening. It's something that I feel privileged to be able to do, to share my story. It's a unique one. It's not something that is typical for our location and our area, and it's a privilege for you to have me up on here. We met a few months back at a book signing event in Hampton, New Hampshire, and it's just I'm just happy that people want to hear my story, and my story is really about the good that came out of the Boston Marathon bombing and not the bad. A lot of people know the bad that happened that day. I thought it was important to share the story so that people can see that good can come out of such tragedy. That being said, on April 15, 2013, I was located at the second location of the bombing on Boylston Street. I'd been to that location year after year after year to watch friends cross the finish line at the marathon. And never in my wildest dreams would I have ever expected this to happen. So with that being said, as my recovery was going on, people were asking me my story. And part of it is that I had many heroes that day that helped me, many amazing people. But there were three people that came to my aid and then kind of stuck with me throughout my recovery. And they're the ones that I consider my perfect strangers. So my book is Perfect Strangers, and it tells a story about resilience and recovery in the aftermath of the bombing. It also tells a story of the four of us individually, of who we were before April 15, 2013, what happened, what their roles were, and then where we are today. Now, as I was going through and talking to people during my recovery and telling them the story of the different people that helped me, so many people kept saying to me, you should write a book, you should write a book, you should write a book. And I think that if you're told something enough, that you end up eventually doing it. And part of the uniqueness about the story, not so much of me losing my right leg and becoming an amputee, but I ended up becoming engaged and marrying the firefighter who helped me that day. So we don't completely go into our story individually together, but it is a little bit in there. And we didn't get engaged until after the book was pretty much done. So, but there's a little hint in there, and the epilogue has been updated in the paperback version to give a little bit more detail on that. So early on, I guess I didn't realize the amount of legs that this story had in regards to the bombing and us as survivors. And it was interesting because people were coming to me wanting to tell my story, wanting me to allow them the rights to tell my story. And I knew nothing about selling rights or allowing others to tell my story. But I knew deep down that if my story was going to be told, it was going to be told without sensationalism, without other people having control over it. I had had an experience with a magazine article where we thought the writer was understanding us and getting us, and we went through revisions of the article that he was going to put in the magazine, and they kept focusing in on, for me personally, on one thing, and it was about how I didn't want to celebrate my 45th birthday. And that article started out, you know, she was depressed on her 45th birthday. And that wasn't the case. I wasn't depressed. I just didn't want to celebrate it. It was one of those birthdays that I would rather have stayed home and done nothing. And as many times as I corrected it in their questions to do the article, that's how that was the first sentence in the article, which really got under my skin. So there was that experience. And then there was the experience where there were some newspaper journalists who, you know, they have to be the first one to get the story in their newspaper and get it out there. And they were doing that so quickly, but yet not fact checking. And so they had someone completely different than Mike Materia helping me with my my transport to the hospital. They had me at the wrong bombing location. They had Mike on a different engine that he isn't on. So, you know, that kind of infuriated me in the sense that, you know, these people were just trying to tell a story and your story and getting it all wrong. I had gone back to work for 6 months after the bombing, and one of my coworkers stopped me in the hallway and basically said to me, "Do you realize that you're part of history?" And that kind of was the ultimate epiphany of, I think we need to do a book, because for those other reasons that I just mentioned, along with that, that if someone was going to tell my story in history, it was going to be me, and we were going to have control of how that story was going to go. So that's kind of part of the reason why, and I'd say ultimately the reason why that we decided to do the book. Now, to get Mike, Shayna, and Shores, who were the three people that helped me that day, that had become my strangers, there was a little coercing, because my husband, Mike, is very quiet and does not like anybody to know his personal business. And he said if the other two would do it, he would do it. And of course, they said they would do it. So he was strong-armed into telling his life, quote-unquote, in this book, and it was a struggle for him. And I think that's one thing that you don't realize, that if you're doing a book in this nature of, like, kind of telling about yourself, it's really hard to open up and put it down on paper and being able to express certain feelings and thoughts and really admitting in some things that people might think are, you know, it's a bad upbringing or a hard upbringing. So in convincing them that we could do this book and we should do this book, I had different people coming to me, like local, it was interesting, a lot of stay-at-home moms came to me and was asking about the story and saying, you know, that they could write it. And they had done some articles for different local newspapers. And I just didn't feel like that was the right fit for us. I wasn't sure how to go about finding a writer, a ghostwriter for this. I personally knew that I wouldn't be able to do the writing. Just, number one, even if I wasn't going through the time that I was going through, I'm not a good writer. That's been proven in school over the years. And even my husband, Mike, said, if we're going to do this book, you need to find someone to write it for us. And so the search went on, and someone put me in contact with a literary agent, and that literary agent ended up putting me in contact with this ghostwriter. Coincidentally, this ghostwriter, although from the New England area, originally lives in Utah. So we did a Skype with her to kind of do a meet and greet, three of us on our side and then Jen Jordan. And I don't know, I felt as though she got it. She's run the marathon before. She's been in there spectating. I think she truly understood what it's like to be in there cheering people on and how this is kind of a special day for New Englanders and more specifically Bostonians. So I decided to go with Jen and have her be the ghostwriter. Now, certain things I didn't know. I didn't know that there's a thing called a proposal, and I had heard about this proposal and people do it differently. Some people write the proposal and then shop it out to publishers. And then some people find a publisher and then do a proposal. I don't believe that there's any right or wrong way of doing it. I think it's based on who you're working with and how it goes. And so it was interesting that we got her to do this and she put the packet together. And I don't know, it was probably about 50 pages telling a chapter. It had a chapter. It had the index of what the book would have. It had some sample topics and kind of what our book was going to be about. Now, again, not knowing anything of this situation, she ended up doing that. And then the literary agent that I had hired shopped it out to a bunch of different publishers. Now, this was basically 2 years after the bombing. So our process really started once we found Jennifer in 2015 with the proposal and shopping it out to the different publishers. Before this, though, a few other of the Boston Marathon survivors had done books right out of the get-go. Jeff Bowman had done a book, Stronger, initially, and then the Norton brothers had done a book. And then there were a couple of reporters, local newspaper reporters, that went and did their own book kind of about the day, but also talking about the survivors, some survivors anyways. And so I thought that our story was different because it involved the four of us. But I did hear that those other books didn't sell as well as it expected or anticipated. So I think when we shopped around to the different publishers, some of them were hesitant to pick up our book. So we eventually had five publishers that were interested, kind of did a telephone, I guess, interview, you would call it, to speak more and get a flavor of who I was and the other people in the book. And out of those five, two people decided to go to auction and bid on our proposal. So in the end, we ended up going with Public Affairs, which was part of Perseus at the time, and has since been bought out by Hachette. Now, doing a book is out of my knowledge, my realm of knowledge of the whole industry, and I find it a very difficult one to weed through. They do want books that are going to catch people's eyes. I get that, and get people's attention. So we would have to go through different edits of the chapters. And Jen Jordan, the ghostwriter, did a great job. She interviewed me, my parents, my sister, the people I was with at the marathon that day, friends, relatives, people that weren't even with me that day, other first responders. And she did the same for Shore's family and friends, Mike's family and friends, and Shayna's family and friends. So she really took it on and kind of got everybody's information and then started writing. And then when she had done a chapter, the publisher really wanted to kind of control in the beginning a chapter at each time. So it got kind of tiresome for Jen, who is a writer. She's a journalist at heart, and also has done a book in the past called K2, which was about women hikers up at K2. And so we did a couple of individual chapters to the publisher, and then she asked if she could kind of maybe do four chapters at a time. But every time she sent me a chapter, I would read it from page one to, say, page 50. And then I'd send it back to her with corrections, or how I felt like she didn't really get my voice or didn't really get Mike's story, and how, like, what we really meant by it. And then she would take it and then rewrite it, and then she'd send it back. And at that point, I would read it from page one to page 60. So I wanted to make sure that it all flowed appropriately, that there wasn't any inconsistencies or things that didn't sound right, that wasn't really us, or etc. And that process shockingly took 2 years to start to finish of getting the book published. And it was finally, the hardcover was released on April of 2017. Now, as I went through with the process of it as well, the publisher had a picture of what the cover would look like. And I think we had a picture of what the cover would look like on the book. They wanted us to do, which I feel as though is kind of the, it seems like it's the way people are doing covers these days, especially when it's a kind of a biography or whatever, where they have people standing on the cover with just a colored background. So you're kind of floating in there and kind of posed. So as much as I explained who the four of us are and were, and that we're not very poseable, like if that's even a word, people, we wanted it to be natural. We didn't want the book sensationalized. We wanted it to be natural. We wanted people to be able to hear our voice as they were reading it. And that's how we wanted the cover to be. And I know that the cover needed to show that I wear prosthesis, because that's what the book is about. The book is called Perfect Strangers, and I felt as though that we all, the four of us, really needed to be on this cover, but we needed to be natural. So they sent us to a studio for a photo shoot to see if they could get us to cover, and they wanted Mike to wear his firefighter uniform, and they wanted Shayna to wear her police uniform, and they don't go around in their uniforms every day. But then again, you really wanted to know who they were, and then they were positioning Shores and posing Shores, because he's a doll, like he's just the cutest thing ever. And so, you know, after seeing it, it was just so unnatural for us. And I went to the publisher and to the designer, and I asked, if I took a shot at it, if I could find a photographer that, and I'd pay for it need be, if I could find a photographer to do a photo shoot for us and you liked one of them better, could we go with that cover? And they said, yeah, sure, good luck, basically, with it. And so we had been at an event, I think it was in 2015, and they had done this guy, just who's a freelance, does it for fun, hobby, took a photo of the four of us at this event, and it was awesome. Mike was in his dress up uniform, and Shana was in her uniform, and it was me and Shores, you know, and it was just a great picture. The only problem that was waist up, and you couldn't see my prosthesis. So I contacted this photographer and I said, Mark, you know, I'll pay you, but do you think you could kind of recreate this somehow, somewhere, some way? And he said, absolutely no problem. And my goal was to actually get the background of Austin, because that's where we all quote unquote met. And so I said, how about Sunday morning, bright and early in the seaport behind where kind of near the courthouse is, because then you can get the whole background of the custom house. And it was kind of a dreary, misty Sunday morning at like 7:30. Nobody was back there. And so I was able to convince Mike to be in his uniform and Shana. And so we ended up going back there. He did a few photos, and that is what became our hardcover. So I was very thankful with that. Now, the soft cover has since come out, which came out April of 2018. And the publisher has changed the cover, and it's just me on the cover now, which I mean, I love the picture, but I don't think it tells the story of what the book is about. And I think that's important, that a cover reflects what's in the book. Now, again, I have never been in this industry, and I have no idea if that's right or wrong or whatever, but in my mind, I think the picture is what catches you, and then you read the title, and it will give you a gist of what's in the book. So, I don't know. I mean, I think it's been an interesting ride. I have found that doing the book has been long, tedious, with the whole back and forth thing. And I also found that it was very emotional in many ways. I think it was therapeutic for me to tell the story of what happened to me. I found it very emotional because I did not know all of Shores' story. I didn't know all of Mike's story or Shana's story. So as I was doing the editing and the proofreading, I personally found it a page turner, even though I knew how it ended. So to say, it was so interesting for me to hear their vision of what they went through that day and how they helped me and the different things that kind of went on in their lives. So I found that really, truly very emotional, extremely emotional for me to read all of that, but kind of get an understanding of what their part was in that day. So that was difficult. And then the other difficult part was to tell my story as I was growing up and my perception of my childhood. And I found it very interesting that my parents had different views of my view of growing up. And I mean, I had a very good childhood. I had a normal, typical childhood. We would do family vacations. We'd rent cottages up at Hampton Beach for the summer. We'd come here to Portsmouth. We'd go to Strawberry Bank. We would do all kinds of family things. But my dad was a school teacher, and he was very, not in a bad way, but regimented. And so he wanted us to learn how to do chores. So we, back in the day, when I was growing up, we had a wood-burning stove. We would have to stack the firewood that he chopped. We would have to mow the lawn on a ride-on lawnmower. He wanted to make sure I said that. and shovel the driveway in the snowstorms. And, you know, looking back at it, and I think for him reading it on paper, it made him sound like he was a disciplinarian, but in a way he was. Not to a detriment, though, but I think to the positive side of things. And I think that my sister and I both grew up very strong because of that. But it was very emotional. And for both of us, for him to read my perception of him and growing up and the life that we had versus what his perception of it was and why he did what he did with us and chores and, you know, trying to keep us educated, because he wanted us to have a good future, and he did. He lined us up appropriately, and I think that, you know, is credit to his parenting. But it was so weird because ultimately, if you do read the book, Perfect Strangers, my mom is a bit crazy, and it comes out in the book. And it's in her words, not mine, the ghostwriter, Jen. I went to lunch with her, with the two of them, my mom and Jen, and Jen would ask my mom questions, and she recorded my mom's answers on her little tape recorder. And so Jen took, what she took and put in the book is straight out of my mom's mouth, no one else's. So it's very interesting, and I was nervous when I was reading it, and then I thought that I would give my mom and my dad the opportunity to read it and make comments on what they thought about the book. I also sent it to one of the other survivors that I've become very close with, who I didn't know prior, and she has since lost both legs. But I thought that she has a very good sense and outlook on things, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't sensationalizing other situations that happened that day. I didn't want to offend any of the other survivors or those of the parents of those deceased. So I asked this other survivor to read the book, and called her a couple weeks later, and I said, Jess, what did you think? And her first reaction was like, Roseanne, what's your mother going to think about this? And I said, oh my God, Jen, she loved it. She loved it. She said, crazy sells, and make me as crazy as you want. And I said, well, no one had to make you crazy because everything that's in that book came out of your mouth. So, you know, it was just interesting because I was more worried about how my mom was going to perceive it than my dad. And it ended up being flipped where it really bothered my dad to read those words. So I found that very interesting of the process to do it. So if anybody's going to write a biography and include parents or friends or whatever, I think give them the courtesy to let them read it and before it goes to be published, because I think it was important for us to have this breakthrough prior to the book becoming public. And, you know, I think I found it part of the special process of it all, really, in doing that. So it was very interesting, the whole publishing thing. And I can go on and on, Steve, if you want me to, about my experience with the publisher, which, and the marketing aspect of it. I find like I'm at a dead end with that part of it, because I feel like I don't even think I've spoken to my literary agent or the publisher in at least 9 months. So, I don't get royalties or anything like that.
Yeah,
so.
Wow, that's going to be another whole can of worms. Let me do my brief presentation because I have a million questions for you.
Okay.
And I want to get my presentation out of the way so I can get to those.
Sounds good.
And I'm sure other people have questions too.
Like I said, I could keep going.
Awesome. We'll give you a chance to do that
okay.
in a few minutes. As I get my computer set up here, let me once again explain to the people at home, the podcast listeners, that this is presented by Mott Publishing, which is a little mom and pop, literally a mom and pop publishing company. And we started by publishing our own books, and now we help other people self-publish their books. So we're doing this totally from a self-publishing standpoint. I think it's a nice contrast here that we have someone who's traditionally published and somebody who's self-published. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that some of the processes that I'm going through right now in self-publishing, and compare and contrast them with your experiences. Now, I have a PowerPoint I have a visual presentation ready, but I didn't do my homework and I didn't contact the station to find out whether they had changed the password to their system. And I got here tonight and discovered that they have, and there's no one here who can tell me what the password is. So I will put the graphics on the website. I do that with the other podcast too. Whenever I do a visual, I put the PDFs up there. So if you find this podcast on Mott Publishing, you will, if you look around, you'll see some PDFs that will tell you what's in these graphics that I'm talking about. But here's the situation. I started a novel how many years ago? 48 years ago, 1972, I had an idea. And that idea percolated for many years, and I took notes. And in 2012, I decided, okay, I'm going to write this novel. And I collected all of those notes and put them into files and started working on it seriously. So I've been working on this for 48 years, but only 8 years, you know, diligently. And now I'm hopefully months away from publishing the book. So I got to do all the last minute things. Probably things that you didn't have to, Roseanne, that you didn't have to deal with too much because the publisher took care of those. But some of the things you've already brought up. So anyway, my novel is called All Cars Run to Park Street. And basically it's a story of a girl who was born in the Boston subway. Her parents work there and they never allow her out of the subway. She lives her whole life there underground. And she can only go to parts of the subway that are underground. She can't go above ground to, say, Kenmore Station or something like that. And now it's 1968, and she's about 21 years old, and she meets a boy. And I won't tell you anything more about that, but that's basically what the book is all about. So now I've finished the second draft of the book, and I've gone through a process that we refer to as alpha readers. Now, there is alpha readers and beta readers, and the terminology is borrowed from software development, which I also did for many years. And an alpha reader means somebody that you know closely and trust and know that they have the patience because your software is going to be full of bugs, but you just want to get a rough feeling about whether everything is right or not. And so my alpha readers were my wife and my daughter. Now, generally when we meet authors and they tell me that their editors or readers are their family, I cringe because they're probably not as good. I mean, I'm going to be blunt here. They're probably not as smart as the two people that I had. I won't go into the details, but my wife can spot a typo from 4.5 blocks away on a foggy night. She can look at a page and say, right there, there's a double word. Over here, there's a word missing. This is something wrong with this punctuation. I don't know what it is. And then she'll come to me and say, tell me what's wrong with this punctuation. My daughter is completely thorough, and so I sent her the draft, and she wrote hundreds of comments on it. So I'll show you how that process works. So for alpha readers, you find some people who are close to you, and the book is still pretty rough, and you haven't even finished the second draft, for example. That was a situation I was in. First thing you have to do is find out what format they want. The different formats for your readers could be Word, PDF, an ebook, which could either be for a Kindle or for all of the other ebook readers, and it could be a printout. And both Marilyn, my wife, and Wendy, my daughter, wanted printouts. My daughter doesn't live nearby, so I sent her the file, and she printed it out herself. And in publishing, generally, that's the way it works. You're working with, I don't know if this was your experience,
you get
galleys or
yeah.
That's printed out and you pencil in your changes. So then from them, Marilyn just made a few comments and I went and fixed the things that she pointed out. But my daughter pointed out a lot of things that I had sent her a PDF file. So after she wrote all of her notes on the printout, she typed them in as comments to the PDF file. Now, a lot of the authors that we work with don't know a lot about using writing software, and I myself wasn't even aware of how powerful PDF comments are. And it's something that I just want to throw out there for writers, that if you're going to be working with readers, alpha readers, beta readers, and then editors, the PDF format is a good way to go. Once you get to editors, they usually want Word, and then you have to use their words, what they call track changes. So you send the Word document to the editor. The editor in the margin puts changes. Then you have to then send it back to you, and you have to enter it back into your draft for the next draft. I do have some examples of the software and how it works, but I won't do that right now. Next thing I want to talk about is the cover. Now, we're really kind of small potatoes, this not publishing. You know, we've published 11 books. We're not hashing, you know. And I'm really had for years have been sick to death of hearing people say, people judge the book by the cover. And it's true, but I hate the fact that it's true. I mean, it's just one of those things. Because if, when you go into a bookstore, a lot of times you can look at 20 different books and have no idea what any one of them is about. And then you can look at 20 others and you know this is a paranormal romance. You look at the cover without even looking at the title. This is paranormal romance. This is a crime book. This is an erotic romance. This is because the covers are all the same. And many covers are just something bizarre. Like if you look at the first cover of Catch-22, it's just kind of a odd shape with something that might be a man attached to a ball or something like that. And it doesn't tell you anything about what Catch-22 is. Now that we've lived with the book for all these years, and many of us love the book, when you look at that image, you get a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling. Ah, that's Catch-22. The image did not make the book made the image, in my experience. Now, Roseanne's story is fascinating to me about her covers. I think she was right, and that the publisher doing the paperback was wrong. It's probably still very good, but I'm going to have to look at the two of them again now, having this bit of knowledge. It's fascinating. Now, what I did, fortunately, we have a friend who is he's been a friend of our daughter's since high school. And, of course, those of you listening to the podcast have no idea. You know, I could be 19. You don't know. But it's a long time. And he's a graphic artist, and he does graphic novels. And he's an excellent pencil and ink and color ink drawing artist. And a friend of the family and knows us. And the story, my book is based on Marilyn myself. It's kind of a fictionalized autobiography. So I sent him the second draft of the book, and he read through it, and then he went and he had written some books about Boston. Some of his graphic novels are set in Boston, and he, like myself, is a fan of the subway system, a love-hate relationship with the subway system. We love it except when we're standing there and waiting for the train that doesn't come. And so he immersed himself in images of the Boston subway, and then he drew a sketch, a pencil sketch, and he got... I hadn't told him anything about what I wanted on the cover, and it was nearly perfect what he did. He has a very important scene that in the subway is based on the stairway that leads down into Park Street Station and also up from Park Street Station. And part of the plot is that Eva, the girl who was born in the subway, has never been out. She wants to go up. And Jim, who is the boy she meets, is just about to graduate from college in 1968. His draft for deferment will run out, and he's opposed to the Vietnam War, and he wants to escape, and he's heard about the Underground Railway, which of course is a metaphorical term, but so you can see he wants to descend into the subway. So the stairway and is very important. And what the artist did was he drew a skylight. A really nice guy. Well, there isn't one in that. I'm trying to be as accurate as I can, and there isn't one there. And he said, I took a little license, but when I saw it, it's absolutely perfect. It's a chance for Eva to see a little bit of, that's all she can see of the sky, is that little piece of the sky. And that's a great idea that I then went back and worked into the book, which I hadn't done before. And then there are some people waiting for the trolley, and there are the story evolves, and there's some magical realism, and there are some ghosts in the book. And so he has already set some of those, they're kind of way down the ramp in the distance, and he's already penciled them in such a way that some of them could be ghosts. So he had all of this stuff worked into the book. And then we started exchanging emails, and I'd say, I like this, I would like more of that, I would like less of this. So he's drawing it to spec. You know, he's drawing it to give me exactly what I want. So I'm, for the first time in my life, really excited about a book cover.
That's right.
I think it's going to be a great cover. So I'm not going to go into any more of the details of that because I want to get back to Roseanne's story. I think it's fascinating. Once again, on the website, you'll find, I should mention, once again, I need to plug the website. This is maat publishing, mottpublishing.com or .net, either one will get you there. And at the top of the page, you'll see a link to the podcast, and that will take you to a page that has the audios and the visuals for all of the podcasts, and it's updated each month. This podcast was made on March 10th, so this will be going up probably in the middle of March. I wanted to ask you about more about your cover. That when they when the publisher did the paperback, did they discuss with you that they were going to change the cover before they did it?
They did discuss with me on that, but I have to say, because I had fought so hard with other things, that I really said, you know what, just do what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, I just really didn't have it in me to fight for it again, and then to ask somebody to do me another favor of taking another photo of the four of us. And I do get, in a sense, though, too, that the paperback is a little bit smaller than the hardcover, and maybe it would have gotten muddied if you had all of what's going on the hardcover on the softcover. So, I mean, I kind of get why they just took a pre-existing photo and did that, but I think we could have done it with another pre-existing photo that maybe had the four of us that wasn't so busy.
Yeah, okay. The busyness is a concern of mine, not my cover, because a lot of covers are just on the front, but some have an image that wraps around the spine and to the back.
Right.
And that's what mine is going to do, and so there's just a lot of detail in there. So it looks great in the PDF, but I'm wondering if it's going to be too busy and I'm going to have to thin it out again.
Right, right.
But on the other hand, I might be glad to just let it be. It's going to be different anyway, so I think I might let it just be what it is.
And right.
If it's busy, it's okay.
And I mean, they could have, you know, you bring up an interesting concept of having it drawn versus like a photo. Mm-hmm. And that could have been something else that we had discussed. But I also think, too, that they really didn't have any money in the budget, so to say, to do anything different other than pay to use a pre-existing photo.
Oh, yeah.
So, not that I had any sort of budget to do anything with, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have a marketing budget, really. So anything that I've done, like, I think they might have paid for a hotel in New York on Staten Island, because I asked to do a book signing on Staten Island. My husband's family lives on Staten Island. And so they basically paid for me to stay at a hotel and do a Barnes & Noble book signing, but that was really kind of my only budget.
Wow.
Expense.
A lot of authors that we meet, they have dreams of going with a big five publisher, and that they're going to have all kinds of marketing, and that they're going to get free transportation around the country, and put up in posh hotels. And
yeah,
I've never met anybody to whom that has happened.
No, very disenchanted with that part of it, because I think you do think, and maybe it's because you see big names, mm-hmm. and you assume that that's how it rolls on a regular basis for normal Joe Schmo or Roseanne Stoya. But they didn't even really give me a list of, like, I think they had set up like two or three book signings, and that was it.
Yeah.
If I say three, that's a lot. It might have only been one or two, and that they really had put into place in advance for the book release, which I was kind of shocked. I threw my own book release party, which you think people pay for or do, and nope, I have a friend who's a bartender at a place in Boston, and I said, can you ask if they'll do it? And they gave me discounted pricing for it, and had to kind of build my own PR for it. If I were to do it again, and I wasn't so fuzzy brained after everything with being on meds and everything that happened, I would strongly suggest self-publishing, or to find a local publisher like yourselves to work with. I think it's more personal. And I think you would understand the client better than it being one of the bigger publishing houses.
Yeah, I think that's a good point for our listeners to hear, authors who are thinking of getting their first book out, that you do lose a lot of control with your over your book. Sometimes the editors are very insistent in making changes that you don't want.
Yeah.
The covers, you may have no input whatsoever into the covers. We've talked about that in previous podcasts. Mm-hmm. And once again, the few people I know, I know someone who was published by St. Martin's Press and somebody who was published by Random House and a few other people with large publishers, and they've all said the same thing. There was one author, I've mentioned this before, Jeff Deck, who's been on the show several times, has published a lot of books, and he published for Random House, and he said, I used my advance to publish, to support my my first trip around the country to sell the book. So
yeah, the advance I got paid for the ghostwriter, the literary agent, and an attorney. So didn't even get me anywhere.
So we're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
We should be a ghostwriter, literary.
I know. It's people, like, I know friends in different places I go, people think that when you have a book published, I think people assume you make money, which I would have thought that you make some money, but no. And even the literary agent is like, you'll never make up the advance. So it's just for fun, I guess, to meet people. I think for me, it's to talk about the book, and it's therapeutic for me to talk about my experience. And then I also do public speaking now. So I think with doing the public speaking, it has an edge if you have a book. So that's been a positive experience out of it, with having the book available to sell when I do some of my events.
Yeah, it gives you credibility too, of when you're looking for public speaking events, having a book makes it a lot easier for you
yes.
to get them.
Yes.
A lot of what we've done, a lot of self-publishing. We've had 9 years to work on this, and we started thinking that bookstores would be great, so we lined up some things in bookstores. And once again, I've heard a lot of authors tell us this, that it's not uncommon for you to be the only one sitting there in the store for during your supposed book signing.
Yes. And you have to be crafty too about it, because I did one, I don't know, two Septembers ago, and I wasn't thinking, but it was the Patriots home opener game. Oh. It was 1 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, and it was like 90 degrees out. It was like a really warm September day. And the only person that showed up was my dad and like my aunt or something like that, you know? And I'm like, they already know the story. They already have the book, at least one copy of the book, if not multiple copies of the book. And, you know, lesson learned now to look at the calendar and say, okay, this is what's going on when I'm booking something, to really kind of look at the time of year, the time of day, the location, what events, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So,
and these days there's so much going on. Like, even when we were trying to pick a night every month to have this show, there's always something every night going
Absolutely.
On in Portsmouth. And that's only a small city. A big city like Boston or New York or something, there's so much going on. It's just something we all have to deal with. And as you say, you have to look at it as fun. It is fun. It's fun to go out and do events and to meet. We've met a lot of really fascinating authors.
I'm sure.
And hear their stories and to have the different kinds of experiences. We've done bookstores and we did one at a supermarket. We did one at a culinary, what was it, a cooking school? At a cooking school, and lots of pubs.
And, you know, that's one thing too, like, I don't understand, and maybe this is the norm, but they didn't even get me any of the local grocery stores.
Yeah.
And they didn't get me at, which I would have thought that they would have fought to get me into at least Logan, the airport.
Yeah.
Especially around the anniversary of the bombing and the marathon. So people who were flying in to run the marathon from all over the world would see the book in the airport.
Yeah.
And no one has supported me. Like I wrote to Hudson myself. And they said that, you know, they would try to see what they could do, but I haven't heard anything again. So, I mean, other than, you know, it's tight. And I probably should send them another copy again now that we're coming up on the 7th year anniversary next month. So, you know, and I don't know, how do you get them in the grocery store? How does that work?
We just happen to know someone that's
yeah.
almost all of them. I mean, obvious things like bookstores you can go into and libraries, and you know what to expect there. But a lot of things have been just people we know that we just happen to know somebody who owned a...
Interesting.
I'm a jazz guitar player, and for some reason, the owner of Philbrick's here in Portsmouth for many years would have live music in his grocery store.
Oh,
so
wow.
So you go in there on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon, and there's two jazz players, you know.
Interesting.
And people loved it.
Yeah.
And so we suggested that we have a book event and do the same. We didn't sell many books, but it was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
They liked the food.
Yeah, they liked it. Yeah, we always, for the book, when we're selling the cookbook, of course, Marilyn prepares food from the cookbook, so people love
that.
Oh,
that's a great idea.
But, you know, that eats into what little profits we get.
Yeah. 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 It has been a weird experience.
Yeah.
So... I try to tell people the good, the bad, the ugly of how I've gone through it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I think we do a lot of this, a lot of that on this show over the years. And I think it tends to not discourage people, which is a good thing. I mean, people who really want to write, really want to write.
Right.
And they're not really going to get discouraged and give up, I don't think. We don't see that happening. We just see them kind of accepting, okay, I have to lower my expectations, and which is probably in the long run good for writers. And,
yeah. I mean, I think I still would have written the book knowing what I know now, but I don't think, I do know I would have done it differently, and I don't think that I would be so discouraged or kind of angry, in a sense, at them for, you know, different things. It was, I think, January before the 5-year anniversary, and I said, okay, this is a big anniversary. In January, I'm like, what are we going to do? How are we going to attack this? Like, I sat down with my literary agent and said, you know, how are we going to go about this? And so we talked about a bunch of ideas, and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she came back to me, and she's like, well, did you do this, this, and this? And then in my mind, I'm like, I thought that was something that you were going to work on, because that's what you kind of get paid for doing. But yeah, no. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what the 10% or 15% I paid to them for a contract review. And then that was kind of it.
Wow.
So.
And you said you don't get royalties from the publisher?
No. I mean, it goes towards my advance.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay.
And I think
so until you pay back your advance, you don't get any checks.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So, yeah, no.
And at least with self-publishing, you put the money out up front, and, you know, if you have a box of books sitting there that you paid for, it's a sunk cost. So every time you sell a book,
it's motivation, yay! Yeah.
Even though
absolutely.
You only make a couple dollars, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a friend who... has started kind of writing poetry out of an unfortunate family situation, but he's amazing. And I told him he should publish his work. And, you know, I said I would chat with him and kind of work him through some of that and see if it is. But I mean, he's not ready to do that quite yet. But if I can guide someone else in the situation, then,
yeah.
You know, I'd like to be helpful with that.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's see if these throngs of people in the audience here have any questions for Roseanne.
This is like a marketing question.
Okay.
What did you, what kind of marketing tools did you use to, I don't know, promote your book yourself? And, did you rely rely heavily on social media or other aspects? Or what helped you the most?
So social media has been huge. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, those have been really huge in regards to getting my name out there and getting people to share it. So that has really been, and I've even tried hiring a PR person, and that didn't go well. And I've tried hiring my niece, who's right out of college with a marketing degree, but she's got a full-time job. So it's really staying current on social media. And then also, I think too, if you can get yourself on local radio, you kind of really have to put yourself out there in any sort of way that comes to your to you. So, you know, you have to really use whatever tools that have become useful or made you're aware of, and just take advantage of them and use it. So, I mean, I peddle my book everywhere, and then the other thing is I have friends that peddle my book for me sometimes too, where I did do the Nantucket Book Festival one June, and Mike Shores and Shayna came with me, and while I was at the festival selling books, they went to have lunch, but they brought one of their books, one of the books or whatever, or even just told the story, and then they came over and they're like, oh, we got three people who at the restaurant that want your book. So you kind of have to have the book out there, and if you have, I'm an awful self-promoter, I'm awful at it, but I've been in restaurants at breakfast with friends, and then all of a sudden they tell the waiter about the book, see, this is her on the cover, and then like three of the wait staff buy the book. So you kind of have to take advantage of any of it that comes to you, but social media has been huge. And obviously cheaper than having to pay for something, you know, which, like you said, takes away from any income that you have if you're paying for PR or advertising.
Which social media do you find was most helpful?
I think Instagram and the Facebook page that I have that link the two of them. I think those are, because you can boost advertisements on Facebook, and so you can pay, and it's not a lot. I mean, I think you could pay like $15 for them to boost it, and I think that helps too, so that your event becomes like an ad on people's pages, and it reaches many more people, not just who you're friends with, but like friends of friends of friends. So I think between the two, Instagram and the Facebook and boosting help, and then also podcasts have been great. Just finding what podcasts that, you know, connect with you for whatever reason.
Cool.
And those tend to be free too, to be on a podcast, so that's helpful.
Yeah, and for the listeners who have never been on a podcast, most of them are not like this one, which is really a live show that's recorded and then put out later. And most
True.
Of them are, a lot of them you can do remotely. They're just a telephone call or Skype or something like that. And so if you wanted to be on WPM, you'd have to be in the New England area. But there are lots and lots of podcasts out there that will call you up or Skype with you and get your name out there. And it's hard to track exactly what the benefit of that is. You can't. Maybe you get a spike in sales one week.
Right.
It happens to be the week after you were on that show. Is that correlated or not?
It's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell, so you just have to keep doing it and doing it and doing it. That's what all of our authors tell us.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. I think if I stop being present, meaning stop doing the podcast or doing interviews or being in events, I think that's when I start to fall wayside. So if I stay on top of it, I notice that it stays more active, more consistent.
Other questions? Well, I have a question about working with a ghostwriter. I'm trying to think if we had, and Jeff Deck works part-time as a ghostwriter, along with writing his own books. And he's the only one we've had who is or has used a ghostwriter. Oh, there was one There was one gentleman we did a book event with. Do you remember? It was in Hampton or somewhere like that. His approach is to do ghostwriting for celebrities.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And the book that he had just published had something to do with some celebrity. I don't remember who it was because I don't like celebrities. but it was about dogs who can sniff diabetes.
Oh,
dogs who are trained to let their owner know when
their blood
and
sugar's low. Or
so he was a ghostwriter, very very interesting guy. But I didn't get to talk to him, and his presentation was very interesting. And he had done some well-known celebrities. But the one thing that I was kind of upset about was later when I went and researched his books, it wasn't until then that I found out that he had built up a lot of excitement about these dogs. And I can imagine a lot of people would start to say, hey, maybe I could get one of them. But the training of the dog costs $100,000.
Oh, it's, yes.
At least. So
yes.
you have to be able to afford $100,000 dog.
Right, right. They do have grants and things that, because in my situation, we've come into contact with and part of an organization called NEEDS, which they do service dogs. And I mean, these are highly trained service dogs where if someone sneezes a particular way, he knows to go get a tissue. If they say, burr, I'm cold, he knows to go get a blanket. And they do have funding that will pay for part of it. And I think a lot of them have that situation that it doesn't cost the full 100 grand, but it does. It costs a lot of money to raise these animals, get them trained, and then give it off to those that need them. So, switching gears back to the writing and all that, I think you need to find a ghostwriter that connects with you. And I have had so many people who have read the book that then hear me speak or whatever and say, oh my God, I read the book and could hear your voice. Or I've had family members say, I could hear you telling the story. In the first bookstore book reading that I did was at Porter Square in Cambridge. And we have a cousin that doesn't live far from there, an older cousin, my mom's cousin, and she came and she said, you know what I like about this book, Roseanne? And I was like, what's that, Franny? She goes, you didn't sugarcoat your mom. This is who she is, and this is who you get in the book. And so for the ghost writer to be able to capture all of our characters like that distinctively, for family members and people to say, I could hear your voice, blah, 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 that made me feel good that she was the right person to do the book. And you never know, because you go through the process and you don't know if they're the right ones or not, and you have disagreements. I mean, we had disagreements through the course of it, monetary disagreements, because we didn't get as much of offering for the book as we thought. So then I had to renegotiate with her contract, and it was just, so you do become very familiar with that person, and it has to be someone that you can work through those difficult times with, yet still respect each other and get the job done. Obviously you wouldn't want them to not do a good job, and she really, really did a great job.
And you found her
through a literary agent. Yes. Yes.
We've had a couple of authors come through in the audience here who have a story to tell, but they don't feel that they have the time or the skill to write it themselves. And we've tried suggesting ghostwriters. So I think it's the points that you made are very important. And a few people come to mind who I might even send them an email and say, you will enjoy this podcast,
right?
Because...
I would never have been able to do it. We would not have a book if we didn't have a ghostwriter. It wouldn't been able to be done, time-wise, energy-wise, focus, and all the craziness that had really gone on for the 5 years following everything.
Yeah.
We were kept very busy.
Oh, I can imagine. Well, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, one big blur. but yeah, I mean, having a ghostwriter really helped out doing it. And then being able to make sure it was in our voice.
Yeah.
So, and I've had other people, I've been at book signings and talks and things like that. And I've had people raise their hand and say, are you going to do a sequel? Like, as if I'm some character. And I was like, oh, I think my husband will divorce me if I make him do another book. I think he'll kill me.
Because I was going to ask you, when you said that you there was something in the epilogue of your book where you mentioned you, yourself and your husband, and I was thinking, oh, another book there? But I guess not, no.
You know, I kicked myself because in the early days of everything, one of my former coworkers who came to visit when I was in rehab, you know, gave me a nice little like notebook, and I should have been keeping a journal. And so the ghostwriter was like, you should keep a journal, keep a journal, keep a journal, write these things down that pop into your head, just write them, jot them, keep them down. Never did that. And then after the book got published, I was like, well, maybe I should keep a journal in case we want to do a second book, or even if it's just about me type of thing, because they don't want to do it. I still haven't done the journal.
Oh.
So, yeah, shame
Ooh,
on me. So one on strong, one, if you don't take anything away from the podcast tonight, the one strong thing is keep a journal if your writing's about yourself or an experience. I think that journal is everything, everything.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I have to come up in when I was in college, when journal writing was something new that was just being done in college as a teaching tool. And so I got into the habit early, and I literally have boxes full of paper notebooks at home.
Oh, wow.
And I've told this story before, but one of the reasons I have so much information that I can put into my novel is because when my daughter was in high school, I got my first computer in 1984, so I've been using computers since then. And I had all these paper notebooks, and I wanted to get some of that stuff into the computer. And so we bought our daughter her prom dress, and 2 days before the prom, she said, I can't wear this dress. I need another dress. And I said, I can't buy you another dress, but I'll make you a deal. If you'll type up my journals, I'll buy you another dress. So I went through and I marked in red what I wanted her to type, and she spent months and months and months typing it. And she was, I'm very grateful to her for that.
Wow. Did she get the dress?
She got the dress, okay. And she loved it. She hated the prom, but oh no.
I get that.
But really writing a journal is very important. And the thing that I've learned in going back and looking at journals that I wrote 50 years ago is you never have enough detail in your journal.
Right.
Write much more detail and write the things that hurt. Is really write the things that you think, oh, this is so intense, I'm never going to forget this, so I'll just write a little bit about it here and there. And you'll be surprised how your subconscious will try to bury that.
Absolutely.
And just looking at something that's got a little bit of detail on the page will bring it back to you. I was riding home from, I mentioned a jazz guitar player, I was riding home from a gig with a drummer that I've been playing with for many years. And he's been running marathons, and he's run, I don't know, PJ, forgive me if I have the number wrong, but I think 20 marathons in 20 different states.
Wow.
And his goal is to run a marathon in every state in the country.
God bless him.
And he said, and he's just starting to read poetry, and he's just starting, he's not a kid, but he's just starting to read poetry and just starting to write poetry. He's really excited about it. And he said, you know, I really would like to write about this experience. And at the same time, he was going through recovering alcoholism and discovering religion. So these things are all tied together. And he wants to write a book about it, which I think is great. And I said, you know, write it down. Write it all down as soon as it happens. When you're in Hawaii and you've just finished that race, write about it, because you think at the time, I'll remember this. Believe me, I'm old enough to be almost your grandfather. You won't.
I know. And you know what? The other thing, too, which we all, I would say, the majority of us have access to, and it's so easy, is the voice recorder on your cell phones.
Yeah.
And I think if you do a voice recording of whatever the incident might be, you also then get the emotion that's involved in it. And so you can at least have that captured in that, and then if you need to recall it, you can hear the emotion, you can have a little bit more detail than writing, because sometimes writing, you kind of lose that So I think the voice recordings on the phone, or even if you carry a little tape recorder around or something, that you can just say, oh, I need to record this, and put it down.
I think that's a great point. I personally cannot stand the sound of my own voice when it's recorded.
I hate mine.
But
oh,
I can't
it's awful.
Stand the and I can't stand the sight of my own handwriting.
Oh,
so
wow.
I have to do everything on the computer when I look at my handwriting. So you have to find what's right, you know.
Well, that's true. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that I wish we had had voice, you know, I wish we'd had phones back when we were young.
Right.
Would have captured a lot more detail.
Yeah.
And videos too, you know, because you can.
I'm kind of glad we didn't have phones way back then.
Yeah. For many other reasons. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, another question.
Yeah, I'm curious if you've, I know you talked about marketing, if you've ever done any of the book festivals, like say the Boston Book Festivals, and if you have, what your thoughts are, because those are pretty pricey.
Yeah, no, I haven't. The only festival that I did was the Nantucket one, and a friend of a friend was able to get me in like last minute. So I've called on a couple of different types of events like that, and I think they want like $500 for a table. And that's defeating the purpose of selling the book,
right,
in
I'm
a sense
curious about, like,
yeah,
done it, you know, what, or
no. And yeah, I think it's probably a great event, just too pricey. So, and I don't know, you know, maybe if you have another service that you can maybe barter with them on, I don't know if they do something along those lines, but I haven't done any of those.
Yeah, I was thinking it'd be great as a speaker, because they have speakers at different locations like churches and stuff.
Right.
You know. Boston and your experience.
So my goal this year, this winter, was to kind of get myself out there to, I've started to put a letter together, and so I can send stuff out to different groups and things, and the book conferences were one of them. But then with the radio audience, podcast audience can't see, is that I fractured my right wrist. So for the last 3 weeks, my arm has been tied up in a cast, and writing has been, or even typing has been very, very difficult. And it's kind of put me into a tizzy, and I haven't gotten anything done.
Well, you do have a phone, right? You could use a voice recorder. Somebody recommended that to me just recently.
I wonder who that was. So, you know, looking stuff up and all that, but I'm hoping in the next week or two to sit back down and to really focus on that.
Yeah. Spring's a good time.
Yes. Because there's a lot of good conferences in the fall and the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can get the stuff out, hopefully it's not too late. And if it is, then maybe next year.
Yeah, and if you could be a featured speaker.
That would be amazing.
That would take down the cost.
Right, exactly.
We should plug some book events. Speaking of that, Mott Publishing takes part in and sponsors many book events. We have one coming up this Saturday, March
14th,
from 12 to 4 at a Freethinker's Corner in Dover, New Hampshire. Of course, by the time I get this audio mixed and edited and put up on the site, that will be history, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. We're also sponsoring another book event at the Art Center in Dover in September called Wine, Words, and Jazz, and we'll have about a dozen authors, free wine, and myself and my duo partner, Danny Harrington, will be playing some jazz for that. So make sure that you get out there. I'm getting the high sign from the boss. Yes.
Indie Author Day.
Oh, Indie Author Day. Oh, yes. It's in April, and I'm forgetting the date. There's an event in New Hampshire. I think it's just New Hampshire, maybe nationwide. I'm not sure, but it's called Independent Bookstore Day, and there's an organization that sponsors it. The Organization of the Independent Bookstores. And one of the things they do is they put together a little booklet that lists bookstores that are partaking in this, and they make a kind of tour map for you. And so if you go to each of these bookstores and have your book stamped, then you get some kind of a prize, or you get a chance to win something at a raffle or something like that. So we'll be taking part in Independent Bookstore Day at the Freethinkers Corner in April, and that will be listed on our events page on the Mott Publishing site. But to authors who are just getting started with promoting themselves, I want to urge you to go to start to attend these events before you need to take part in them.
That's a good point.
You'll meet people, you'll learn things. They're free and open to the public in almost every situation. There's another one coming up that just came to mind. Authors on the Sea. What is it called?
Authors by the Sea.
It's going to be at Cisco Brewers, which used to be Red Hook Brewery, here in Portsmouth. And it's in April, and I've forgotten the date, but I better find out what the date is because we're part of it. And I'm also talking about bartering. We barter with a friend of ours who is running the event, or part of the organization running the event. And so I'm going to be playing jazz guitar as background music in exchange for our table fee. Oh. So if you have any skills, if you're a writer and you have mm-hmm. skills, you know, maybe you can cook for them, maybe you can wash their car, you know, find something to do. Because as Roseanne said, some of these events to get a table can be more expensive than anything you would make selling your books. People say, oh, well, you know, it's only $50 for the table. It's a good deal. But honestly, you're probably not going to make $5 profit on any individual book. So you got to sell 10 books just to break even.
Right.
And 10 books, frankly, is hard to sell, even for the most well-known authors. So, you know, find ways that you can barter and get your way into these events. Any other questions? Yes.
Do you ever have, when you're doing ghostwriting, or do you ever have ghostwriters or proofreaders or editors who are, a little bit sensitive and say, oh no, you can't use this work, you know, I've got these people. I find that so ridiculous, because I feel a book should be raw and, you know, expressive. Do you ever run into that issue?
I did. Just because of our subject of the book, there were a few things in there that you know, we had to be careful with. And I think just personally, because I guess we didn't want it to be misinterpreted, more or less, is really kind of the way that we wanted to be careful. And you know, and then the other part of it is some things, like my husband's a firefighter. He's a veteran of the Army, and he also didn't want to come off as being like self-righteous or, you know, patting himself on the back on certain things. And so we wanted to be careful. So I guess we didn't have the ghostwriter say to us, you know, oh, you can't say that, but we really kind of watched how we said things so that we weren't perceived in either bragging or being racist about something, or, you know, we kind of had to take in a lot of different personalities, a lot of different situations with religion and things along those lines. And I think we did it more so that we weren't being perceived in the wrong light.
Yeah, because the reason I bring that up was I had this proofreader. I'm writing this compilation of short stories that are for a young adult audience. And one of them I had this one line in there that said, away like a shot. And the proofreaders said, well, maybe you should take out the word shot, because they might, I don't know, be a little too, uh, I don't know, they might perceive that as something else, or, you know, like a gunshot. I did take it out, but at the same time, I was kind of rolling my eyes, like, was this really, did you really have to make a big deal out of that?
Right. Right.
That's a tough one, because we often hear about trigger words, that a word that will trigger an emotional reaction in somebody who has had a trauma. And it's a tough call, because almost anything can be a trigger word to
yeah.
almost anyone. There are so many different experiences
right.
out there. So I think you have to take the context too. If the rest of the context that we use that phrase had to do with, say, a schoolroom, well, that raises the sensitivity level quite a bit. Then I would say, yeah, I get the connection there. There's a good reason not to use that phrase. Maybe I can use something else. But if you're just watching somebody running a foot race, then yeah, you're just describing it. So I think you have to take the context into consideration, and you have to consider your potential audience, because you're going to alienate people no matter what you do. There are going to be some people who are just going to be alienated, and you have to decide, I think, how many readers am I willing to give up? If I think that this is really right for my book at this point, and I know that, so, you know, I know if Aunt Sally saw it, she would feel this way, and if my friend Dave from junior high school read it, he would hate me forever. And if you do too much of that, you won't write anything. So it's a tough call from both the writer's point of view and from the publisher's point of view, because you want to keep the integrity of your work, and we want you to do that if we're publishing your work. But when we also have to evaluate people who want us to publish them and say, does this offend us? If it offends us, then that's the first hurdle that they have to get over. And then, is it going to offend other people? Is it gratuitous, as they talk about gratuitous violence on television, things like that? There are many writers who have kind of indirectly approached us, and we read their work, and the F word is just there. It's gratuitous. It's just there because they want, they're I don't know, they think they're 12-year-old boys standing on a street corner, but the character in the book is not. The author is just indulging in juvenile behavior, in our opinion. So we find other things to do. Oh, I'm sorry, I have to. My meter is running out. We'll talk about this later, you know, or something. We have to find ways.
And I think, as a publisher too, you probably see and hear a lot of those situations. So if you're working with two or three different writers and you see that they're not using the right language for the character, or it could be misconstrued, or it could offend people, you must see it as a whole and know what works and what doesn't work. So I think, you know, when a publisher offers suggestions, I think it's probably because they've had an experience with something similar and has realized that it works or doesn't work, or, you know, you're going to offend or not offend based on how it goes. So, I mean, you also have to listen to the publisher to understand that they have a little bit of an expertise in it. And are they always right? I apologize, Steve, Marilyn. No, they're not, you know. But I think you pick your battles too. And if you find it that it's something that's going to really tell your story the way you want it told and is not changing your story, it's making your story and it's not going to offend, then you fight for it. But other than that, I think you listen to the publisher and kind of work with them on it.
Yeah, I think that's a balanced approach. And you do have to be careful. As Roseanne was talking about her ghostwriter, and I think you were lucky that you got a good ghostwriter first try,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds like you went through what would be expected with any ghostwriter. There are going to be differences of opinions and so on and so forth. But I think the thing that bothers me about so many of the writers I meet locally, or the beginning writers, is that they don't know how to evaluate an editor or a publisher or a PR representative, or they don't know anything about it, and they don't accept the fact that they have to learn how to evaluate these. You have to learn how to tell a good publisher from a shark, and you have to be able to tell the difference between a person who thinks that he knows everything about grammar because he learned it in high school, and a person who has studied and read lots of books and has lots of knowledge and so on and so forth. It's taken me my lifetime to begin to understand some of that stuff. So for beginning writers, you know, part of your job is to learn to evaluate who really is going to be able to give you good advice. And it's hard. It's
yeah.
hard to figure that out. We all get fooled all the time. Other questions or comments? Oh, before I forget, what's the terminology? Your social contacts or online contacts or whatever, your
social
website,
media.
Social media, who are you online and where do people find you?
You can find me at robostrong.com, and that's RO for Roseanne, Bo for Boston, and then strong.com. On Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and that's RoboStrong and my maiden last name, Stoya. So RoboStrong, S as in Sam, D as in David, OIA. And you can find me there. And the book is Perfect Strangers. You can get it Barnes & Noble, Indy, or Amazon.
Any place local in Portsmouth, Dover, the Seacoast area? Any bookstores?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, again, that's the great work of my publisher and my literary agent.
Okay.
Unless I peddle them. So, yeah, we're working on that.
Yeah. One of the things that we do is we just go into bookstores, and sometimes we went into one recently that was just not going to be appropriate for our book. It's just selling used paper bags and things like that. But again, for authors, what you need to do is go to your local bookstores, especially the indie bookstores. They're struggling just as hard or harder as we are as authors. And you'd be surprised if you just walk in with your book under your arm. What some do is that they'll just look at it quickly and then say yes or no, and then it could either be on consignment or they could buy it outright.
Mm-hmm.
And the purchase price varies. Some take 40%, some takes 30%,
yeah.
Right?
Okay. Actually, you know, I guess I misspoke because I've had my book in the Galley Hatch, in the bookstore that they have at the Galley Hatch in Hampton, New Hampshire. She's bought some for me and then has sold them out of there as well. So.
Well, that's where we met. The book was at the Galley Hatch.
Yes, exactly. So.
And our books are there, and we haven't sold any, but it's nice to walk. We went in there. Well, they sold one. But it's such a thrill to walk in, especially
and see it there.
Especially to a restaurant and see your book there. And that's part of the fun of this. That I won't say that makes it worthwhile, but it is a nice reward after all the stuff that you have to do.
I agree.
It is a nice reward.
I agree.
And I push that too because I've been a musician for 50 years, and I know that the musicians and the club owners have to work together. They have to support each other. And there are some club owners who are not honorable, and there are some musicians who are not honorable. But generally, if they work together, they benefit. And the same thing with authors and bookstores and libraries and schools and all the other places where books exist. We have to work together. We have to, what is it, hang together or we'll hang separately? So get out and support your local bookstores. Other questions or comments? Anything else you'd like to add?
I'd just like to say thank you for having me on this. Although I'm a one and done author, it has been really an amazing experience in figuring out the process, and it's a whole new industry that I would never have known or had an idea to be a part of, and I've met some really great people along the way like yourselves, so thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to have you, and a very fascinating story.
Thank you.
And I used to read the books, or at least part of the books, of all the authors we've had on the show, but now that we have piles of books from these authors, I'm way behind reading, but I'm really looking forward to reading your book And it was a pleasure meeting you and having you on the show.
Thank you. And I'll tell you, it's a quick read.
Okay.
If I can read it in a day, anybody can read it in a day. It's a little intense, but you can read it in a day.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine it has to be intense.
Yeah. Well, I like that. I don't like it when just drags on and on describing every little detail from someone's shirt collar.
Or repetitive. Repetitive.
Like
yeah.
Tolkien.
Yeah.
Torrance for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sometimes enjoy a little bit of that, you know. But I like having both. I like having an easy read, and I like having a difficult read.
Mm-hmm.
But I could use an easy read.
It's a quick read. I don't
quick
know if
read.
It's easy. It's
okay,
quick.
No, you know. Sorry, that's a wrong term.
No, no.
Quick read. Yeah.
There's a lot of laughing in there.
Yeah.
So.
Good. Good. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you once again. This is the March. 2020, we'll wrap it up. WPM will continue until November. It'll be the second Tuesday of each month here at WSCA Community Radio in Portsmouth. And we want to thank WSCA for letting us use their space and for supporting us. And so I would recommend that you support them also. They're a community organization, and they are funded by you. So please do support them. And thank you.
Thank you.